This video really celebrates our theme today of life hacks. But it's also a great celebration of Father's Day. Happy Father's Day, everyone. In both cases, red-green is perfect. Now, most of us have employed some kind of a life hack. A life hack is a shortcut. It's a skill. It's some unique method that increases productivity and efficiency in any walk of life. So think about travel hacks. When you used to be able to fly, you could tie a colored piece of fabric onto your suitcase handle so it would be easy for you to find it amongst all the other black suitcases. There's organizing hacks, camping hacks, there's productivity hacks. There's a whole website dedicated to IKEA hacks. The only hack that I couldn't find there was the one that would help me assemble whatever I bought. I'd like you just now, in the chat, to just write in your favorite hack, something that you figured out that's kind of working for you. So I want you to just take a moment and do that. Today, we continue in Ecclesiastes. We've looked at positive disruption from the angle of working backwards in chapter 1. We've looked at the timestamp in chapter 3. And in the first 9 chapters of Ecclesiastes, there are a lot of negative waves. All is meaningless. Doing is meaningless. Having is meaningless. Even our sense of being is meaningless in the eyes of the teacher. Recently, Dawn and I watched Christopher Robin. It's a great movie. And if you're reflecting on being a father, this would be a wonderful movie to watch. The character from Christopher Robin that really resonates with this talk is Eeyore. You remember? The little cup half empty donkey. Here's one of his quotes. End of the road. Nothing to do. No hope of things getting better. Sounds like Saturday night at my place. See, Eeyore would fit right in with Solomon and Ecclesiastes. Now think for a second about Winnie the Pooh. Who's your favorite character? Why don't you toss that in and we'll see how many Tigger fans there are out there. But in Ecclesiastes, I think Eeyore is in fact the one that is most connected to this. The word meaningless, 33 times it occurs. Chasing after the wind, 9 times. And this idea of being under the sun, 29 times. See, under the sun, it's kind of setting the context. It's the vantage point from which the teacher is making his observations and drawing his conclusions. So the question is, are there any life hacks for dealing with all of this? Today, we're going to look and we're going to see some things that will really help us with this challenge of this meaningless perspective on life that the teacher has painted. We're going to look at this world from a very different vantage point. And we're going to see that the preacher isn't really saying that life is meaningless. He's saying that life viewed and lived apart from God is meaningless. If you look at life from the place where there is no God, the writer of Ecclesiastes' conclusion makes sense. But the Bible warns us not to do that. In Psalm 53, it says this, "The fool says in his heart, there is no God." The fool, that's another word that shows up 25 times in Ecclesiastes. But we should not miss the fact that this book is permeated with some other words. God is referenced 41 times. The word wise and wisdom show up 51 times. And when we get to chapter 11, Solomon makes a transition. He moves towards the brief but stunning climax in chapter 12. And you're going to have to come back next week to hear that. He shows us how to live in this world that he sees as meaningless apart from God. Let's read the first six verses of Ecclesiastes chapter 11. Ship your grain across the sea. After many days, you may receive a return. Invest in seven ventures. Yes, in eight. You do not know what disaster may come upon the land. If clouds are full of water, they pour rain on the earth. Whether a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where it falls, there it will lie. Whoever watches the wind will not plant. Whoever looks at the clouds will not reap. As you do not know the path of the wind or how the body is formed in the mother's womb, so you cannot understand the work of God, the maker of all things. Sow your seed in the morning, and at evening let your hands not be idle, for you do not know which will succeed, whether this or that, or whether both will do equally well. That first verse, ship your grain across the sea. After many days, you may receive a return. See, the first thing that Solomon does in this passage is that he challenges us to invest. And here the example in the NIV translation is commerce. This was actually Solomon's world. In 1 Kings chapter 10, verses 22 and 23, we get a picture of this. The king had a fleet of trading ships at sea along with the ships of Hiram. Once every 3 years it returned carrying gold and silver and ivory and apes and baboons. King Solomon was greater in riches and wisdom than all the other kings of the earth. But the principle here is far more expansive. This idea of investment, of stewardship, relates to not just his experience around shipping, but it relates to our time, our talent, our treasure, and even this idea of stewarding the gospel. These verses have led to all kinds of interpretations. Some have said that it's referring to generosity. Others have said, like the NIV translates it, that it's relating to business and commerce. Still others suggest that it is agricultural in nature and relates to the sowing of seed in places like the Nile Delta. As I reflect on this, it reminds me of my favorite answer on multiple choice tests. You know the one. D, all of the above. That's right, all of the above. These verses, they're challenging, but the reality is that they're saying something very powerful to us, the hearers, and it's to invest, to be good stewards with our time, our talent, our treasure, with the richness of the gospel. Don't buy into this all is meaningless story. Take what you have and invest it. Is there uncertainty? Yes. Will everything turn out the way that you predicted? Probably not. But ship your grain. Invest your time in others. Invest your talents and gifts in serving and ministry. One of the things that you could be doing in this season where you have a little bit more time is you could be taking what we call the shape test. It's a wonderful opportunity for you to see how God has wired you and the direction that He would like you to move in terms of your service. They're going to click the link to that up in the chats, or you can just go to faccalgary.com, click on Give Back, and then hit Volunteering, and you'll see it right there. But we also invest our financial resources. Your generous giving, your worship in giving is such an encouragement and is fueling so much ministry impact in our church, our community, and our world. We just want to say thank you. It's interesting as you think about all the chatter in the midst of the downturn. One of the things that comes up routinely is this idea of where should I be investing in the downturn? How do I find that high potential deal? I would like to suggest to you today that the best investment you could make in the downturn is in the kingdom. Invest in Jesus and all that He is doing in the world. If this idea of financial investment in the kingdom is new to you, you may remember Pastor James' challenge from several weeks ago. To begin with, $25 a week was the idea of a medium pizza. I would encourage you to join us as we invest together in what God is doing and calling us into. But we also invest in the gospel. Rick Warren said that people are more likely to come to Christ when they are under tension or in transition. Let me say that again. People are more likely to come to Christ when they are under tension or in transition. Plenty of both of those going on right now, right? Revival doesn't come out of good times. It comes out of hard times. And the reality is that there's a tremendous amount of power in the gospel for these days. And when we think about what the Bible has to say about sharing the good news, it's often using the images from farming and agriculture. Matthew 13, verses 3 to 9, it says this: "Then he told them many things in parables, saying, 'A farmer went out to sow his seed. And as he was scattering the seed, some fell along the path, and the birds came and ate it up. Some fell on rocky places, where it did not have much soil. It sprang up quickly, because the soil was shallow. But when the sun came up, the plants were scorched, and they withered because they had no root. Other seed fell among thorns, which grew up and choked the plants. Still other seed fell on good soil, where it produced a crop, 100, 60, or 30 times what was sown. Whoever has ears, let him hear.'" We talk from time to time around here about this idea of spiritual CPR. CPR stands for cultivating and planting and reaping, the very thing that's being described in the passage that we just looked at. It's a beautiful picture of the process that God is inviting us into, to engage with people, cultivating. That's breaking up the hard soil of their preconceived notions of Jesus and the faith. Planting, that ability to inject into the conversation the good news of Jesus and to speak about spiritual things. And then reaping, the opportunity to see somebody come to Jesus. It's a beautiful picture. See, crisis turns the soil and it increases the receptivity to the gospel. Will we lean into this? Will we invest? Will we engage in CPR in what may be the most optimal conditions for revival and sharing the good news in our entire lifetime? Solomon goes on to say this: "Invest in 7 ventures, yes, in 8. You do not know what disaster may come upon the land." And see, the reality is that in the Jewish mind, 7 was the number of completion, a fullness. And so, here Solomon challenges us to go beyond. He uses an old Jewish formula which drives home the truth. Not 7, but 8. Be extravagant. There is also the challenge to diversify. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. Invest. Be a good steward. Broadly. Solomon was realistic. There is risk, and he understood that. I'm sure when his fleet came back, once every 3 years, there were surprises, there were losses, there were disappointments, there had been pirates, there had been defections, there had been shipwrecks. Some of the things that he had been so eager to see were on the bottom of some ocean somewhere. Life is full of risk and uncertainty. That doesn't make it meaningless. If you change your vantage point to look at it with God in the picture, rather than just under the sun, you can see and then must act on the need to invest. What's he saying in this portion of the text? He's saying invest broadly and extravagantly. What a great call to us today. But now we move on to another powerful lesson. Verse 3 says this, if clouds are full of water, they pour rain on the earth. Whether a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where it falls, there it will lie. And whoever watches the wind will not plant. Whoever looks at the clouds will not reap. And see, the warning here relates to the danger of being paralyzed by less than perfect conditions. Sound familiar? I think this pandemic is the perfect environment to freeze us, to have us standing like that farmer going, no, no, it's not good. I'm going to wait. Maybe tomorrow will be better. There's too much rain. There's too much wind. And so what do? We circle the wagons. We become self-protective. We hold tightly onto our time, our talent, and our treasure, afraid to release it as extravagant investments in what God is doing. We can actually learn from history on this point about seizing the day. In the early centuries of the church, something rather remarkable happened. There was explosive growth, and it actually ended up being profoundly moving in terms of its impact on culture. One sociologist, Rodney Stark, wrote a book, and the book was entitled The Rise of Christianity. And he tried to come up with what was it that resulted in Christianity experiencing this explosive growth. And one of the things that he discovered and makes a very compelling argument for is the reality that Christians, during the plagues in the early centuries, had a profound impact on the culture around them by the way they served. They leaned in. When everybody else was running for the hills, they ran into what was happening. And they engaged, they cared, they served, they ministered. And it left an indelible mark on people. In fact, on all of culture. I'm going to quote a section of what he says because it is really quite interesting to see from the unbeliever's perspective, the person who was actually antagonistic to the gospel, his take on what had happened. So listen to this. Thus, a century later, the Emperor Julian launched a campaign to institute pagan charities in an effort to match the Christians. Julian complained in a letter to the high priest of Galatia in 362 that the pagans needed to equal the virtues of the Christians, for recent Christian growth was caused by their moral character, quote, even if pretended, and by their benevolence towards strangers and care for the graves of the dead. In a letter to another priest, Julian wrote, I think that when the poor happen to be neglected and overlooked by our priests, the impious Galileans observed this and devoted themselves to benevolence. And he also wrote, the impious Galileans support not only their poor, but ours as well. Everyone can see that our people lack aid from us. The way the Christians worked and moved and ministered in a time of crisis had a profound impact, so that a century later, it's still being felt. And the emperor of the day, completely antagonistic to Christianity, is doing everything he can to find a way to minimize that impact. Theirs was a strategic time, and they seized it. And it changed the spiritual landscape of the Roman world. And beyond, the ripples from their investments, they reach out to us today. It's incredible, isn't it? I believe we face a similar time. This may well be the most strategic time for the gospel and the kingdom in our lifetime. Now is not the time to wait, to hold back. Now is not the time to go, oh, it's looking a little stormy, maybe later. No, just because we don't have it all figured out is no reason for us not to act. Since when have we all figured out anyway? Most of us thought we had it figured out in January. How'd that work out? If we go on in the text, it just reiterates this for us. It helps us see. Verse 5. As you don't know the path of the wind or how the body is formed in a mother's womb, so you cannot understand the work of God, the maker of all things. Sow your seed in the morning, and at evening let your hands not be idle, for you do not know which will succeed, whether this or that, or whether both will do equally well. You don't know. The weather. How could you know the weather? We get three seasons in a day here in southern Alberta. You don't know how to fully comprehend the mystery of creation and life. It's interesting. I was thinking about this as it relates to Father's Day, and I was thinking back to the birth of our three children. Here we were in a delivery room, four people, all completely focused on the person who wasn't there yet. And then, all of a sudden, there were five. It's incredible. What a mystery. Reminds me actually of the birth of our second child. We were going through the process, and the nurse had told Dawn and I that it's going to be hours. So they told me, go down to the lunchroom, get some lunch, get some coffee, take your time, come back in a while. We're going to be here for forever. So I go down and I get some lunch and I have a coffee and I come walking back up onto the maternity ward and I walk into Dawn's room and there is nothing there. She's gone. The bed's gone. I'm like, okay, what's going on here? And I step back out into the hallway just as this nurse in full scrubs sticks her head out the door and says, Mr. Bombernard, get in here. And so I go sprinting into the room and things had accelerated a lot faster than they thought. One of the crazy Father's Day memories for me. But it was at the end of that, as we sat there with another little human being in the room, that I was reminded afresh of the mystery of so much that I don't know. And yet in the midst of all of that, God was at work. We cannot fully understand. And yet God is at work in the mysteries of life, in the weather, in the wonder of conception, a new life. There is a whole lot more going on than we understand under the sun. Ecclesiastes 7:24 says this, when times are good, be happy, but when times are bad, consider this. God has made the one as well as the other. Therefore, no one can discover anything about their future. And so, if you take the notion that there is no God, then it is all meaningless. What's the point? But there is a God. And that changes everything. Instead of being meaningless, it stirs up faith in us because God is at work. And this leads to what was for Solomon an obvious response. We see it in the text. Sow your seed in the morning, and at evening let your hands not be idle, for you do not know which will succeed, whether this or that, or whether both will do equally well. And so here, Solomon makes this incredible linkage between this idea of God being present and at work, which stirs up faith in us, and our response to that, which is action. Action. Sow your seed. Let your hands not be idle. And we see in the New Testament the way this is echoed out in the book of James, chapter 2, verse 17. Faith by itself, if it is not accompanied by actions, is dead. I think Solomon would have said amen to that. I think he would have said, yes, God is present. He is at work. That should stir up faith in us. And that faith must lead to action. This is a biblical faith. And as such, it always shows itself in action. James tells us that. There's the story of the talents in Matthew 25. They were given talents, and some multiplied them and invested them and grew them, and another didn't. And those that invested were rewarded, and those that didn't invest, they missed out. See, there's a link between the call to invest and the biblical call to be good stewards. We need to be faithful with what God has given us. That's a challenge we all need to embrace. Sowing and reaping. It's a powerful, powerful principle. In Galatians 6:7, it says, "Do not be deceived. God cannot be mocked. A man reaps what he sows." And then speaking specifically about the idea of giving, in 2 Corinthians 9:6, Paul says this, "Remember this, whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly. And whoever sows generously will also reap generously." So what is the writer here actually trying to teach us? What is it that he's really trying to say about this idea that life under the sun is meaningless apart from God, but that with God, everything changes? I think it's this: invest broadly, extravagantly, by faith, knowing that there is more than what we see under the sun. God is present. He's at work. And this challenge from Solomon will change everything. It'll change it for you. It'll change it for those around you. Oh, friends, what is he asking of you today? When you think about this idea, these amazing hacks that help us understand that life is not meaningless, but actually calls us to invest and to act. What is he asking of you today? I'd like you to stop and to reflect on this. And then, by faith, I would challenge you to move to action. What an incredible thing it would be for us to be mobilized, just like that church in the first centuries, leaving an impact that would ripple down for generations if God tarries. I think that's the call from Solomon to us today. You may be watching, listening, and you may be in a position where you really are only living under the sun. You haven't got God in the equation. You've been trying to do it your own way, on your own terms, and you've come to the same conclusion that Solomon did. It's all meaningless. This is not working. Today, though, my prayer is that it's become clear. There's more. I think the Spirit of God has been nudging many of you, saying, "I'm at work. I'm drawing you to myself right now." He's voicing the invitation to you by His Spirit in this moment. Life can change for you. From that sense of everything's meaningless to enjoying a relationship with the God who is present in your life and in our world. Jesus made the invitation so clear in John 10:10. He said, "I have come that you might have life and that you might have it to the full, that you might have it abundantly." What a contrast to this life under the sun where everything is meaningless. And I would love to invite you into that relationship today. And I would encourage you to pray with me right now. Oh, friend, if that's you, and you realize that living life under the sun hasn't worked out that well for you, and you'd like to receive Jesus, just pray this prayer quietly along with me in your heart. Father, I come to you today, and I have been living under the sun. And boy, what Solomon says rings true. It is meaningless. I've been doing it my own way. And Lord, I'm sorry. I now see that you want to be in the picture. So Lord, I confess my need for you. Forgive me. I want to turn from living under the sun to living with that reality of God in the mix. God present and active in my life and in my world. And so I invite you into my life as Savior right now. I surrender my life to you and ask you to be my Lord, my leader. And Lord, thank you that in all my days as I thought about this hopeless, meaningless existence, it never occurred to me that I would have this moment where everything changed and you gave me that abundant life. Thank you, Father. Thank you. Amen. Oh, friend, if you prayed that prayer, welcome to the family. And for those of you that know Jesus, my prayer is that you will reflect on that thing that God is calling you to, and that this week will be a week where you will step out into action. God bless you.